The views expressed on The Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show. You're listening to WSFMLP 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Bruce Goodness.
The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. This show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. If you'd like to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. This show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. Firestorm's full calendar of events and a link to some of their catalog of books and zines can be found online at their website, firestorm.coop. This week's episode features a conversation with Ron Sokolsky. Ron is a poet, an anarchist, a surrealist, a pirate radio broadcaster, an author, and more.
Of his many books and articles spanning many topics, most recently published is Breaking Loose, Mutual Acquiescence, or Mutual Aid, out from Little Black Cart.
Ron levels a challenge to readers to move past or break free from the limitations we internalize from engaging with and within, as well as with others within, the system of domination. But first, an announcement. Excerpted from the International Coalition to Free the Angola 3, we have some breaking news. From Friday, April 19th, 2016. Just moments ago, Albert Woodfox, a.k.a. Shaka Sing K, the last remaining member of the Angola 3 still behind bars, was released from prison 43 years and 10 months after he was first put in a 6x9-foot solitary cell for a crime he did not commit. After decades of costly litigation, Louisiana state officials have at last acted in the interest of justice and reached an agreement that brings a long overdue end to this nightmare. Albert has maintained his innocence at every step, and today, on his 69th birthday, he will finally begin a new phase of his life as a free man. This victory belongs to all of us and should motivate us to stand up and demand even more fervently that long-term solitary confinement be abolished, and all the innocent and wrongfully incarcerated to be free.
We're speaking with Ron Sokolsky. Ron is an anarchist, a surrealist, an artist and poet, a pirate radio jockey, and I'm sure much, much more, living in Coast Salish territories, a.k.a. British Columbia, Canada. Thank you very much for coming on the show, Ron.
My pleasure.
Of his many books and articles spanning many topics, most recently published is Breaking Loose, Mutual Acquiescence, or Mutual Aid, out from Little Black Cart. And I'm hoping to speak on that topic and much more over the course of this conversation. Miserabilism is a term that comes up pretty early in Breaking Loose. It's a term that you attribute to the surrealist lexicon. People in a listening audience may think of Dali when the term surrealism is invoked. But Ron, can you expand a little bit on the concept of miserabilism and also on the relationship between anarchism and surrealism?
Yeah, I'm somebody who appreciates both and looks for the intersections between both surrealism and anarchism. And the idea of miserabilism, it's a concept that originated with André Breton and the French surrealists, and eventually was elaborated on quite a bit by an American surrealist by the name of Franklin Rosemont, who was with the Chicago Surrealist Group. And I knew Franklin very well, and it was a big influence on my way of thinking as well. The concept basically says that not only do systems of power and domination create misery, but they create the idea that misery is the only possible reality. And surrealists, of course, are very interested in expanding reality and transforming reality and moving from the miserable to the desirable, or to break loose, you know, to use the title of the book. And so instead of settling for an impoverished and depreciated form of reality, which is what miserabilism is all about. The idea would be to move towards a more exalted form of reality, a more expansive idea of what reality could be. And I should say that, you know, it's not simply escapism. The idea is you question reality, and that activates the radical imagination, and that's certainly valuable in and of itself, but the idea is also to change life and change the world. Those are basic surrealist ideas, and ultimately to create a world where people can live more poetic lives.
And from whence does the surrealist imagination expand, like, or break out? Like, is it that this expansive imagination is something innate to human beings that just gets trained out of us, or is it something that we have to, like, hone and grow?
Well, both. I think it is something we have as human beings as part of our abilities. It's an ability that's been atrophied, and society basically discourages it and encourages us to sort of view reality as fixed, as static, and unchangeable. And so if that's the way you view reality, then the only way you can deal with the unpleasantries that you might encounter in reality is to figure out some way of adapting to reality rather than changing it. Surrealists are interested in moving beyond that, moving into the realm of change, that's what makes surrealism a revolutionary kind of idea, and that's where it connects with anarchy. Most people do think of Salvador Dali when they think of surrealism, and actually, he's very popular in terms of the way people see surrealism. His melting clocks and all that have become a trope that people think of when they think of surrealism, a style and that kind of thing. Surrealism was not in favor of any particular style. It was all about expressing the kinds of anti-miserabilist ways in which more exalted forms of reality exist within the present reality. Rather than thinking of dream and reality as two separate worlds, surrealism saw those two as coming together, and action being the sister of the dream. Dali actually was eventually forced out of the surrealist movement because of the fact that he was very much interested in commercial success, and he, not only that, but supported Franco in Spain and the Spanish fascists, and got close to the Catholic Church, and the surrealists were very anti-clerical. And I say "were" as if the surrealists were are a group that are in the past tense. I don't mean it that way. I mean it in terms of Dali, in terms of historical surrealism. They even decided to use an anagram of his name to show their contempt for Dali. They called him Avida Dollars, which essentially means eager for dollars, greedy. And it's very interesting that in the United States in particular, people associate surrealism with Dali. They associate it with a particular style of art, and they don't really understand, the philosophy of surrealism. Art is, of course, very powerful. It's emblematic, and people relate to art in a way that they don't relate to the written word. And so a lot of the written word of the early surrealists were a lot of those written words were in French, and so quite a bit of it hasn't been translated into English. And one of the things I'm involved in doing is trying to translate some of the material that's in French that has to do with anarchy and surrealism into English. I'm not doing it on my own. I have a cohort in Montreal that's helping me out on this. And in a way, anarchy and surrealism is going to be the subject of my next book. And a lot of that material will appear in that book probably for the first time for an English-speaking audience.
That's quite exciting. You're also involved in the editing of The Oyster Catcher. Can you talk about this a little bit?
Yeah, The Oyster Catcher is essentially a zine, and it has a focus that changes each issue in a way, but the part of it that remains constant throughout is that it's either interested in anarchy, surrealism, or local kinds of things that are related to the island that I live on. And so the best, of course, is when there's overlap between all three of those things. But it tends to be kind of an anarcho-surrealist zine, and its focus is often local whenever, you know, something local sort of jumps out at me that really illuminates some of those other ideas of anarchy and surrealism.
So moving back to Breaking Loose, Mutual Acquiescence or Mutual Aid, I'd like to talk about the term mutual acquiescence, which you coined, in relation to miserabilism. Where does it stand and where do you take it in the essay?
Yeah, well, mutual acquiescence is, in relation to miserabilism, is a dimension through which miserabilism operates and through which miserabilism sustains itself. I basically see mutual acquiescence as the opposite or the negation of mutual aid. Mutual aid is the anarchist concept that everybody knows, and originally it goes back to Kropotkin. And, it's a form of mutual aid. The form that interests me in this argument about mutual acquiescence is the idea of direct action, unmediated action that involves the kind of coming together of people to change things, to change the world in some way, with to change some part of the world or some part of their reality. And so mutual acquiescence I see as the social adhesive that cements the miserablest bricks of alienation and oppression into a wall of domination. So it's the way in which we collude with each other in doing that. In other words, it's the social dimension of the way in which we're enslaved. So that, in other words, it's not simply coming from above us. It's not that the powers that be are doing things that are going to be forcing us into these ways of being that are unwelcome and unpleasant and oppressive, but that we somehow collude with that as well. So really it comes out of this idea that I was grappling with, which is, why don't people revolt? Why isn't there more anarchist revolt in the world? And so in trying to figure that out, I thought, well, if anarchist revolt is connected to direct action, then what would the opposite of direct action be? And that's where mutual acquiescence comes up. There's another way of looking at mutual aid, and there's a lot of people, if you ask them what the opposite of mutual aid was, they would say it was survival of the fittest. In other words, they're thinking of a human nature continuum rather than a continuum of direct action, which is where I'm situating it. And in terms of human nature, this whole social Darwinist ideology that, you know, we survive by pitting ourselves against one another is very different than the anarchist idea of mutual aid, of cooperation as the way in which species survive. And the fact that people continue to justify a miserabilist reality by saying, well, it's, you know, survival of the fittest and, you know, there's nothing we can do about it, is just the way in which mutual acquiescence works. It's the way voluntary servitude happens, where we collude in our own enslavement. It's the social dimension of that. It's not just that we each as individuals do that, but we create these kinds of understandings between each other that allow for that to happen.
So sort of adoption and internalization of mediocre relationships and I guess a refusal to struggle, like basically.
I mean, it's easy to blame all of our problems on the fact that we live in an oppressive, you know, system of capitalism and the state and so on. And I don't mean to take anything away from that. But the way it actually operates in our daily lives is what I'm interested in. You know, how does that oppressive kind of reality get reinforced, you know, in terms of our social relations? So that I think, you know, one way in which that works is that just in terms of the ways we have of communicating with each other, I think, you know, we sort of communicate things to each other casually that have a very deep significance. So, for example, you know, we've all heard the expression and used the expression, I don't exclude myself from this, it is what it is. And if you think about that expression or other expressions like, why not make the best of it, or it's all good, in each case, the it refers to reality. In other words, the first one would be reality is what reality is. The second, why not make the best of reality? The third is reality's all good. And I know each of those expressions has a nuance in the way people use it. But essentially, I see them as phrases that are about resignation and submission, even if there's a sort of a humor to the idea that we'll have to kind of go along with this. It's all about saying suck it up rather than society sucks.
And you point in the essay to Paris Peasant by, or this novel by Luis Aragon that talked about, referred to the principles of why not and making the best of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was back in the 1920s. So surrealists have been grappling with this kind of thing for a long time. I mean, I see it as a lot of people are talking about climate change these days. And I think we need a societal climate change, not the one that's being, you know, foisted upon us. But I kind of have a way of looking at anarchy that maybe is connected to the fact that I live in the Pacific Northwest here, or in Cascadia. And I happen to be very much of a mushroom collector, and, you know, I do a lot of mushrooming in the woods. And I see anarchy is kind of like this spore that needs to be activated. And the way it gets activated is by a very healthy downpour of mutual aid. And the way it ceases to activate is a drought. And the drought of mutual aid is what mutual acquiescence is all about. So that if we want the mushroom spores of anarchy to activate and flourish, I think we have to question all the ways in which we encourage each other to be acquiescent. And that is a way of moving, you know, further along the path to mutual aid and seeing how it impacts our lives. So, you know, I think that we need an anarchist downpour. And I think that it's something that happens because people are often unaware of the way in which they're acquiescent. I think I would include under mutual acquiescence a lot of the false hopes that are offered by forms of mutual aid that are really about cooperation, yes, but they're not fully about unmediated direct action. And that's what we need to vault that wall that mutual acquiescence has created through its social adhesive that keeps it in place. We need to get to more forms of direct action that are not mediated by the state or capitalism. So that, for example, a lot of people, especially right now in the States, are interested in electoral politics. To me, that's a form of mediated kinds of action that people get involved in because they, in some cases, do want to change the world, but they see anything beyond electoral politics as a way of changing the world as unrealistic. So we get back to this idea of reality. There's nothing more subversive, in a sense, than to question reality. Because as long as you accept the boundaries of reality as static and fixed, then, of course, you know, you have to operate within those boundaries in order to bring about any kind of change at all. For surrealists and for anarchists, and here's the connection, you know, possibility goes beyond what is offered to us by reality as we know it, and we can't easily be dismissed by being called unrealistic, even though, you know, I know I've been called unrealistic ever since I was a child, and I think we all were to some extent. I mean, when you do something that your parents or teachers, when you're a young child, when you do something that is considered beyond the boundaries of what's realistically acceptable, which, you know, now as an anarchist, I would say, yes, you know, that's what we should be doing. But when you're a child, you're told that this is inappropriate behavior and you receive lots of, you know, negative reinforcement for that kind of behavior. And you get your positive reinforcement for recognizing those established boundaries. And again, that's a form of miserabilism, you know, where miserabilism is in one of the things that animates mutual acquiescence. And so the idea of the struggle against miserabilism isn't just some abstraction. For me, it's something that's very real in terms of our daily lives.
And you point in, like, near the end of the essay in the conclusions area to a few projects that sort of, for you, emulate examples of people stepping outside the boundaries of what's acceptable and creating a new paradigm or a new reality, right? You point to the ZOD, for instance, in France, and some other land occupation projects. You talk a little bit about the Zapatistas at one point. Those are catching. Those are examples that, even if you can't point to, say, like, oh, it was, you know, it's a perfect example of what anarchy is or what anarchism could be or what full-fledged human beings could be developing, they're at least pushing boundaries and making rules for themselves, right?
Yeah, I tend to want to look for the anarchist trace in everything. I don't always find it, but in some places I find it more than others, and certainly in the case of Lazad, and the other example I look at is the Unist'ot'en here in British Columbia. I like the term you use, catching. Those are catching. They're contagious. They're inspiring. Because for me, the way in which change happens is partly connected to mutual inspiration. We have to inspire each other. In a sense, you know, something that you do that inspires me might cause me to do something that inspires someone else, or, you know, so that it becomes a way in which we are able to communicate with one another about what is possible outside of the boundaries of what is considered acceptable. And to me, what's happening at Lazad and at the Unist'ot'en camp, those are stories of breaking loose. Those are stories of defending land and liberty and traditions and old and new. And they're very much connected to anarchy, even if they aren't, you know, 100% anarchist. So I find those things inspiring. And I think the more of those things that exist, the more likely it is that people will say to themselves that these artificially created boundaries of what is considered to be realistic are questionable, and we might be able to think beyond those narrow kind of fettered ideas of what reality might be, and how we might move towards something that would be more anarchist. That's something that interests me. I mean, that I dedicated the book to the local people here on the island that are part of my community. Not everybody on the island, but I mean my immediate community of people who are fellow anarchists, and they inspire me all the time. They inspire me not only with what they do, but the way, in terms of political activism per se, the idea of you know, resisting something in the streets or on the land, but also the way they live their lives. And you know, radio is a form of possible inspiration as well. When you hear about something on the radio that you didn't know about before, you become potentially inspired by that to take a step maybe that you would not have taken otherwise. So that's to me radio at its most subversive, and that's the kind of radio that appeals to me.
There's a large portion of the essay that struck me as sort of playing with this this assumed dichotomy within anarchist circles or within the greater milieu, at least in North America, between an egoistic or individualistic engagement with the world in terms of kind of what relationships we have with each other, what we personally accept to be the reality, versus collective organizing models and like desired direct action among a number of individuals. And the essay kind of like looks at it, as far as I can see, and says that it's a false split within anarchism between the egoistic or individualistic desire and the collective desire. Can you talk about the individual in relation to the collective and what your essay calls for in terms of this?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I think I want to begin by saying there are very real differences between you know, the idea of egoistic and individualistic engagement and organizing collectively or cooperatively in a communitarian way. And there are differences that I think are important. I don't mean to minimize them. But I think very often they involve people in choosing up sides who don't necessarily have to find themselves at odds with one another. I see anarchy, for example, as a mosaic that has a diversity of truths. Personally, I've learned from all of these various approaches to anarchy. What I've then done, and I think what each of us do, whether we know it or not, is I put those different strands together and build my own personal collage of anarchy, my own way of understanding myself as someone who's an anarchist, and the way in which I interact with the world. So for me, the idea of saying I am this or that, rather than saying I've learned this from that, and I've learned something else from another approach, and maybe I might take a particular emphasis, or maybe that emphasis would be dependent on the situation, but it all goes back in a way to this is an old issue. It's not just a new issue in the 21st century. If you go back to Bakunin, one of the classical anarchists, his statement was liberty without socialism is privilege, injustice, and socialism without liberty is slavery, brutality. Recognizing that, you know, both of those are very important kinds of concepts, liberty and socialism. And he meant it in terms of libertarian socialism, which was a way of saying anarchism and still is in Europe more than here in the States. And if you compare that to a surrealist like André Masson, who said surrealism is the collective experience of individualism, you get the idea that while the two aren't the same, they can feed off each other in a positive way or not. And I'm interested in the positive ways they feed off each other. In terms of contemporary anarchists and people who are associated with the idea of egoism or individualist anarchism, people like Wolfie Landstreicher, and he says individual liberty is should be seen as mutually strengthening rather than threatening to mutuality. Again, the idea that the things aren't in conflict with one another, even though they might have very different trajectories, and even though they might question certain things within each other. To me, the idea that they're mutually resonating or that they can enhance one another is kind of a subtext of my book, in a way. I'm very kind of interested in sort of looking at the ways in which the two can come together. In general, I tend to be interested in crossroads and places of intersection rather than places where people see dichotomies. I like to look for the moments of connection that can be used to build something even more more to my liking and more involved in creating the kind of world that I'd like to see us move towards.
You're listening to The Final Straw Radio on Asheville FM, WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina, and we're speaking with Ron Sokalsky of his many books and articles spanning many topics. Most recently published is Breaking Loose, Mutual Acquiescence or Mutual Aid, out from Little Black Cart. I like your phrasing.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, there's a few times during the conversation so far that you've just turned phrases in such ways that I can't imagine you haven't used them before in writing, but like talking about the social adhesion and the wall. Lovely.
Yeah, I mean, the wall. I've thought of the wall. I mean, it could also be a dam, right?
I mean,
it needs to kind of burst, and your bursts of goodness, right? So you know what bursting is all about. There can be bursts that are destructive and bursts that are creative. You're involved with creative bursts, and that's why we're here.
Maybe it's time to unleash the destructive bursts, because Uh-oh. Destruction can also be a creative act. So radio is another positive thing that you've been talking about a little bit, and you yourself are engaged in radio projects. The first time that I became aware of your work was actually, I found my copy of it, Seizing the Airwaves, a free radio handbook that you edited alongside of Stephen Dunifer and released in the late 90s via AK Press. Can you tell listeners about your experiences with radio, pirate or otherwise, and maybe some of the projects you've been involved in?
Yeah, well, that book came out of the free radio movement in the States, which is not really as much of an active movement as it used to be. But in the late 80s and 90s, it was very active. And I was living in Springfield, Illinois at the time, or just outside of it. And in Springfield, there was a radio station, which most people probably know as Black Liberation Radio, Human Rights Radio. It started out as WTRA, which was took its call letters, which it wasn't legally required to take since it was a pirate station, but it had call letters. TRA stood for Tenants' Rights Association. And it was a station that was broadcasting out of a housing project in Springfield. I lived in a rural area outside of Springfield in Pawnee, which was maybe about a half an hour away, but I was very involved in that station and involved with Mbana Kantako, who was kind of the key conspirator in that project. And basically, it was, he called it 1 watt of truth. It was micro-powered, and eventually got up to be more than 1 watt, but that's the way it started. And he was basically operating out of this housing project, broadcasting to his community, which was an African-American community, and challenging initially police. And then beyond that, a lot of the other systems of occupation and oppression that the black community was encountering in Springfield at the time. So I got involved in that, and Stephen Dunifer, who I did the Seizing the Airwaves book with, you know, was inspired by Obama Station, by that station that I was involved with. And this is the way inspiration works, right? And he decided to do Free Radio Berkeley, which was not only a pirate radio station, but challenging the laws of that governed radio in the States. He had a legal case about the FCC in terms of free speech and whether pirate radio was a form of free speech. So Stephen sort of and I encountered each other in Chicago. He knew I was involved in Black Liberation Radio, and that's how we initially cooked up the idea of Seizing the Airwaves book. These days, I'm involved in a pirate station called Tree Frog Radio, which is in an undisclosed location somewhere in the rainforest of British Columbia. And to me, the power of pirate radio, and I often talk of Tree Frog Radio as an example of squatting the airwaves. It sort of goes back to what we were talking to about earlier about possibility. The fact that it's illegal and the fact that it's transgressive in the way that squatting is, it connects with the anarchist radical idea that legality is not intrinsically linked to possibility. Right? So that's not just about being bad boys and girls by doing a pirate radio station, challenging, you know, the idea of what's possible, and that legality doesn't limit you to what's possible. You can look beyond that. So I see pirate radio as a form of direct action, you know, just going on the air without necessarily needing to have any apps or internet connections. You can just go on the air. It's also a form of culture jamming, challenging the dominant culture, challenging the inequalities of bandwidth in terms of terrestrial radio. And at the same time, the way that pirate radio exists today, it's possible to take advantage of things like podcasts that you do that can be streamed or played on our station, even though we're not connected to the internet. So that we're not connected to the internet in terms of being able to broadcast out using the internet. So we can, though, take advantage of what's available to us. So it's a way of kind of building that all in if we want to. I had been involved previously with one community radio station, which was a college station. Got into a lot of trouble. There was a nuclear power plant that was about to open 30 miles down the road from where that college was located. And before it even opened, we decided to do a radio show, which was a simulated meltdown of the Clinton nuclear power plant. And we announced early on in the show that this was a simulation. And we planned on announcing that regularly every, you know, 5 minutes or so. Well, whoever was in charge of the station at the time didn't hear the initial announcement, and then we went on for about 5 minutes or so. He just flipped out, ran into the station, pulled us off the air, and of course that got people really worried. And there were calls into the station. We kind of made international headlines on that one, kind of a, you know, Orson Welles War of the Worlds kind of thing. But you know, we realized very early on with the limitations of licensed community radio were, that you had to kind of operate within those boundaries. And we just sort of regrouped and did other things. And eventually some of the things that I got involved in had to do with projects that, you know, were ones that I got involved in here in Canada and also in the States. In Canada, I put out a book called Islands of Resistance about pirate radio in Canada with a woman by the name of Marion van der Zaan, who was involved in doing a mobile pirate radio station called Temporary Autonomous Radio. and Andrea Langlois, who had just put out a book called Autonomous Media. Well, I met both of these women at the Victoria Anarchist Book Fair here in British Columbia, and we decided to... there wasn't much information out there about pirate radio in Canada, so we put out that book in 2010. And there's a number of articles in there about radio as a form of resistance, not only in terms of politics, but also in terms of culture. So there's some pieces on radio art and that kind of thing as well.
Can you talk a little bit about what differences you've experienced between the U.S. and Canada in terms of pirate radio and in terms of like reactions of authorities?
Yeah, I think, you know, when I left this pirate radio in the States, it was a time of heavy repression. I don't know if you remember that time in the 90s when they were coming in and busting stations regularly, and they were very proactive. In other words, they were searching out stations. In the past, they had been involved in activity that was complaint-driven, and they weren't doing much in the way of going out and looking for stations. But as more and more pirate stations went on the air, the FCC got very threatened and decided to do that. So that was the repressive wing of what was going on. But there was another wing of what was going on that I see as a form of mutual acquiescence, which was the low-power radio movement. And the low-power radio movement said, okay, well, what we want is not pirate radio, but some of us never really wanted pirate radio, they said. We just wanted access to the airwaves, and licensed access to the airwaves was fine. We wanted to have low-power stations. And so a number of stations decided to go that route and to lobby for low-power FM instead of engaging in what was essentially a very significant battle over the enclosure of the airwaves that was being fought by the pirate radio movement. So with the best of intentions, and I don't mean to denigrate the intentions of the LPFM people, they thought the solution was to lobby Congress for more low-power FM stations. Well, as it turned out, there are a few stations that are kind of interesting, but mostly the stations that were granted licenses were ones that were affiliated with church groups or social welfare groups or the relatively right-wing kinds of programming. So, you know, I see that as a way that the FCC sought to defuse the pirate radio movement and successfully was able to defuse it. A combination of carrot and the stick. The stick was going in and busting radio stations. The carrot was, here's this LPFM thing that we're going to, you know, give you sort of a way of mitigating the fact that, you know, the airwaves are almost totally controlled by either corporations or state programming, in the case of NPR. And NPR was very much in part of the opposition to pirate radio at that time. So in Canada, what you have is sort of the older complaint-driven system. And basically what that means is that unless someone calls up the CRTC, which is like the FCC in the States, they don't go around searching for radio stations. They're not trying to find pirate radio stations and bust them. And so there tends to be a longer possibility that you have of remaining on air. We've been on air 11 years. Now, we realized in going into it, though, that we could, you know, be busted, you know, within weeks of going on the air. So you never know. You don't have that kind of certainty. But we've been around for a long time, and, you know, nobody has complained about us. And what that means is that I think in our case, we're very much community-based. We're based within a community that supports what we're doing. And while they might not listen to all of our shows and they might not approve of everything they hear on our radio station, they like the idea that the community has a voice on the radio station. It's open to anyone in the community who wants to become a member. So the station itself is very, very much anarchist in the way that it's organized, in the sense that once you have a show, once you're a programmer, you're free to do whatever you want on the show, and that we make decisions by consensus and so on, and there's a very minimal amount of bureaucracy. We don't have to do all the things licensed stations have to do. And it's based on camaraderie and, you know, the connection between people in a small community. People like that, and, you know, I think that that's the way in which we've been able to survive. If we were doing something, which I'll say this not to say that it's illegitimate, but just to say that it's different. If we were disrupting existing radio stations, trying to prevent them from broadcasting, which is one way that pirate radio can be used to do culture jamming, right? Then we might have the CRTC come down on us. They actually don't. They don't do the policing themselves. Industry Canada does the policing, but we're not doing that. We've found a place in the airwaves that we've occupied. We're squatting it, and we haven't. While we can be very outspoken, we haven't actively taken on any of the you know, major corporate or government shows that exist that essentially dominate the airwaves. But our hope is that what we do will spread and more people will do what we do. And that's kind of the way it worked originally in the States with the free radio movement that, you know, we wrote about in Seizing the Airwaves.
So you found basically an island of resistance in the FM band?
I think so, yeah. I mean, we get amazing support. I mean, you know, we're an island. We're literally on an island. So if the CRTC or Industry Canada wants to come over and do something with the station, their truck has to go on the ferry with everybody else. We have people who work on the ferry. in fact, we have programmers that work on the ferry. So, you know, we're told if there's any suspicious activity. I even got called up one time by the fire chief of a volunteer fire department. And he said, you know, we're testing our emergency broadcast signal. I think the Industry Canada folks are going to be on the island today between this and this time. You might want to stay off the air. And, you know, it's just sort of informally the way that goes. It's like when there's a cop on the island, the word goes around that there are cops on the island, and you might want to be careful when you drive and not want to drive with a vehicle that is has a busted headlight or whatever. There actually are no police stationed on the island, and so we live in a cop-free environment. It's the kind of place, as you can tell by what I'm talking about, we have a free store and so on, that it's conducive to this kind of activity and supports this kind of voluntary activity that enables us to ignore legalities if necessary, or ignore, you know, commonsensical ideas of reality. And you know, work together in mutual aid, you know, whenever we think it's important to do that.
That sounds like a lovely place you got there.
You should visit sometime.
I would love to. Next time I go up to the Northwest. Thank you. It's kind of funny, like the couple of examples I can think of in the U.S. of like raids on stations that I was aware of was Freak Radio Santa Cruz got raided in the early to mid-2000s.
Yeah.
And as I understand it, I was not there, but the FCC and the police like came in, got the equipment out of a tree, I think is where the transmitter was. And when they went back to their vehicles, they came back to just vehicles just riddled with nails throughout all the tires.
Oh, nice.
I had to get towed.
Yeah. Now there's an inspirational story right there.
Yeah. Also, we had, I was involved in college radio at Sonoma State University. And we didn't, well, there was something very special about our station that we didn't realize. It had been running since 1977, I think, and in 2000 or 2001, maybe it was 2002, I think it was 2001, the station got visited by the FCC because apparently one of our programmers, who is a friend of mine, decided on his noon show to play F*** the FCC by Jello Biafra. And yes, there was a complaint that came to the FCC. They triangulated within a very, very short period of time where our station was and informed us that we never had a license. So we had been a college-based...
I didn't know that.
Yeah, a college-based pirate radio station that was part of the college programming for the communications department, operating for like 20 years without a license. Pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, you know, we have on occasion used some of your podcasts. So, yeah, it's amazing how these things get around. I mean, it's we don't broadcast every show, but we, you know, different programmers take what they want and build their own shows out of it. A lot of it is locally originated programming, but occasionally we bring in some things from outside that seem like they fit in terms of the kind of thing that somebody's up to.
That's really cool. Yeah, I've been sharing content. Well, you may have noticed, but I've been sharing content with these folks based out of Europe from A Radio Berlin, and I took an interview based on a suggestion from a friend about the state of emergency and what's going on with the ZOD and migrants from a project out of the UK. And I think that's one amazing thing about the internet for all the things that it does to the human brain, maybe, or the way that we communicate with each other. It is an amazing, it offers an amazing ability to share voices and spread people's word of mouth by their own mouths. It's really cool.
Yeah, for sure. You know, that Lazad show, you did a couple of Lazad shows, I know at least, and those are the ones that I personally played.
Oh, cool.
No, that was great. I loved those shows.
What kind of programming do you do for No Borders?
It has no borders, so that it basically, there's no genre. And there's no format. It is what I do any particular evening that I do the show. So sometimes it could be all spoken word or interviews and or poetry. And other times it could be music. Sometimes it'll be a combination of the two. It really depends on what moves me. And I did radio in the past, on that college radio station, that community licensed community radio station, that was within genres. I was doing a jazz show, and I did a reggae show and an African show, and I always got I felt confined by the genre that I would want to come in one day and do something completely different, and I never could because, you know, within those kinds of formats, people are expecting the show to be a certain way, and the people at the station who ran the station expected that you kept within those formats. So when I started to do pirate radio, I thought that's the first thing that has to go. It has to be much more spontaneous. Not necessarily spontaneous when I walk into the station, but spontaneous in terms of what I put together that day. Sometimes it will be completely spontaneous when I go into the station, but oftentimes I'll, you know, do, you know, some prep with it, and the prep I do is usually based on something that has come to me within the last day or two before the show airs.
That's something about licensed stations, I think, is that they have the market share mentality of, well, our investors expect a certain thing for the hours, and they're not going to, you know, resubmit funding so that we can pay the government to regulate the airwaves. And they're not going to support us as a community station if we don't offer them their 5 hours a day of classical music or whatever.
Yeah, and that's the voice of miserabilism. That's the voice of, you know, with it. It's also the way in which we're sort of communicate to each other that way. Everybody at the station, sure, there's hierarchy within the station, and the station managers will tell you that. But they're telling you that as something they believe, not as something they're just trying to foist upon you. They really believe that these are the boundaries that are the only boundaries we have to operate in, and therefore this is what we should do. And they don't really they don't really sort of question those assumptions. Some people do, but you know, they kind of take for granted that that's as much as we can expect in a few crumbs from the table.
Yeah, there. One cool thing about the station that I'm working out of right now is that the station's format is based loosely off of WFMU, which I've never I've listened to once, I guess. But
I used to listen to that station growing up. That was I lived in New York. I'm originally from New York, and that was freeform radio has kind of always been close to my heart.
Yeah, so that's the format of the station is freeform. Although people will genreize themselves. If someone's a jazz head, they'll play jazz. Sometimes maybe bring in a few other things. Or there's like a country show that does pop, like country hits from the 1950s through the early 90s or whatever. But occasionally it is kind of fun to hear someone's random like music show just break into an interview and a talk about nothing to do with the music that they were playing, but just what's on their minds. And make space that way.
Nice. Well, congratulations on being one of the few that got away, in a sense, with the FCC.
Well, I guess it's not ever over, right?
No, it never is. Yeah. They're always trying to roll back whatever little gains we make.
Yeah, and even within stations, it's like depending on the mood, things can get conservatized or more liberated.
Yeah, well, I know with licensed community radio, around the time that we were doing this, that the pirate movement was going full blast, there was a big move within licensed community radio, not LPFM, but standard licensed community radio prior to LPFM, to do marketing research. And marketing research basically is what killed it in some ways. They basically crunched numbers and, decided that shows, even though they might be unique and incredible, if they weren't getting as much of an audience share as another show that might not really be all that exciting, would have to go. And that kind of mentality, that lowest common denominator mentality, is always what kills anything creative.
Yeah. I remember being growing up and being a teenager in the Bay Area. I was born in 79, so through the 90s, starting to listen to KPFA, for instance, out of the Bay Area. And I remember the Pacifica takeover attempt that happened at that point. I know there's been a few of them, and how that was going to like limit the freedom of DJs that were actually doing a really good job. Like I know Hard Knock Radio got knocked a few times for some of their coverage and some of their politics and some of their music that they were doing, but they were breaking so many boundaries, not to say laws, but like so many boundaries in terms of what the listening audience could engage with in so many beautiful ways. And they continue to, as far as I'm aware. But you saw
Pacifica
like the other
radio
side.
Radio was the flagship for that kind of thing at one time. And, the same time that was happening in the Bay Area, they were cracking down on WBAI in New York as well, the other Pacifica station.
And didn't the DC station just turn to a almost all music format station?
I'm not sure, but that wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah. And at the same time, like right as the, I guess, what was it, the deregulation of markets by the Clinton administration, I remember hearing some of my favorite stations in the Bay, this really good hip-hop station, KMEL, got bought up by Clear Channel. Same with KITS, Live 105, alt-rock and reggae and ska and all this stuff. They just started standardizing in this really ugly, banal ways.
Yeah. I mean, to me, I don't understand, the thinking on that. I mean, it's like, why would you want to have more of what's available everywhere else? Unless it has to do with commercial considerations, but isn't that what we were opposed to in the first place, right?
Well, Ron, thank you so much for talking. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, no, it's great. It was good getting to meet you over the telephone, and you should come up here sometime. We'll put you on the radio.
I'd love to. And if you come out to the Southeast, let me know. And keep putting out the good stuff. We're speaking with Ron Sikalski.
You're listening to WSFMLP 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Bursa Goodness.
If you'd like to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806.